This is Where Did the Road Go? Our aim is to explore the fringe, to be true skeptics and question openly, to investigate the paranormal, bring light to the dark corners of history, and give a voice to the shunned of science. We deal in mystery and the important questions that these subjects bring to light. What is reality? Who are we? And why are we here? Join us on the web at wheredidtheroadgo.com for a full show archive, links to all our social media, upcoming schedule, and much, much more. Now, join your host Soraya on this week's edition of Where Did the Road Go?
And welcome to this week's Where Did the Road Go? Tonight I'm going to be speaking with Andrew Collins about some of the newest revelations coming out of Göbekli Tepe and his viewpoint on it. As well, we'll be talking about giants and hybrids and things like that. So, before we get to that, I want to remind people we do have a Patreon account. Go to the website, wheredidtheroadgo.com, and you can become a patron of the show for just a couple of bucks. And what that will give you is extra content, maybe some free books, as I've been talking to some people about, and maybe we'll do an open lines type of thing with patrons at some point, where you can talk to us directly, ask us questions, things like that. Us as in whoever is willing to participate. As well, when we do eventually get enough to make some merch, we'll be giving that to you at a discount, if not free in some cases, for patrons. So you're going to get a lot back once we get enough patrons to make it worth doing some stuff. This week, you'll be getting, as a patron, the midweek podcast that I just did with Joshua Cutchin, Mike Hughes, and Red Pill Junkie. And you'll get that before it is posted on the page or on YouTube. You're also going to get a extra segment for patrons only, where we talk about our favorite paranormal movies and the ones that had the most impact on us. And Red Pill Junkie actually tells us something about himself that I don't think he had ever told anyone before. Pretty interesting stuff. That'll be for patrons only. So if you're interested in getting these little bits, they won't be full-length interviews. There'll be little extras from our guests. The full-length interviews, as I said, will already be free. Consider how much stuff we give you for free as it is. You can find the entire archive of shows from the very beginning on the website. We have free books up. We have free videos. All that stuff is going to remain free. The patron thing is for supporting the show and helping us expand so we can maybe get a regular second show a week going. And like I said, merchandise and things like that. And I tend to be very generous with anyone who helps out. So please, if you could spare the couple bucks a month to help us out and you like the show, please do. All right. So now we're going to be talking with Andrew Collins. This was recorded about a week ago with Andrew. And it's a pretty diverse conversation covering everything from Göbekli Tepe to giants and hybrids, etc. So enjoy. All right, and we're here with Andrew Collins. How you doing, Andrew?
I'm fine, thank you, Soraya.
And you have a lot going on.
I do.
And you're let's start off talking briefly about your trip through the U.S. and what you were looking for.
Well, I was there in the spring with my good friends Greg and Laura Little. Every year we'll generally go to one part of the United States. And we'll do research, generally into the mound-building cultures. And we'll go to museums, we'll go to sites, we'll speak to archaeologists. We'll find obscure, ancient places which nobody else has been to for years. And we'll build up a picture. And this year we went to New England, and we're looking into the culture behind the construction of monuments like America's Stonehenge, which is a megalithic monument, very similar in style to some that you'll find in places like Malta, Sardinia, you know, and even Göbekli Tepe in southeast Turkey. You know, you've got stone enclosures with retaining walls, with megalithic, you know, standing stones within those walls, huge flat slabs on top of structures to cover them, like the megalithic dolmens of Europe. And, you know, it's an incredible place. I mean, it's unquestionably prehistoric. It's produced carbon 14 dates, at least 1500 BC. And it's an enigma, and there is evidence there that there may have been activity on the site going back at least to 5000 BC. And that's quite incredible. I mean, you know, it makes it one of the most important sites in the whole of the United States if you're trying to study prehistoric cultures. And around that same area are a large number of stone chambers, which are generally sort of cut into hillsides, but created through the use of large blocks of stone, which are made into beehive shapes, you know, or more, you know, different styles, different shapes and things like that. And these are quite remarkable places. I mean, they're put down by the archaeologists as root houses. In other words, there were places where you would keep, you know, your root vegetables in colonial times. But again, there is lots of evidence that has come out to show that they are pre-Columbian. And you find certain things in common with them. For instance, you'll often find a large piece of quartz stuck into the back wall, you know, just sort of there. I mean, and it seems to be so common that it's obvious that it has a function. And for me, this function would be the movement from this physical world into an otherworldly environment. You know, almost like the holes that are used by shamans, you know, to focus their minds, their thoughts, to project their mind into otherworldly environments during altered states of consciousness. Now, you know, if this was just a root house, you wouldn't have those pieces of flint in the walls. So, you know, we were looking into all of that. Greg has produced various videos based on our research up there. You know, if you just search Greg Little, America Stonehenge, you can watch these on YouTube. And there's links to other sites that we went up to as well. Also, we looked at there are hundreds, if not thousands of miles worth of stone walls. In very obscure places. Again, often these are linked with stone chambers, and they are not of colonial origin. They are pre-colonial, many of them, created by an unknown culture that inhabited the areas of places like New Hampshire and Massachusetts, and even, obviously, where I know you are, in New York State. I mean, and they... They're a mystery. Nobody knows who put them there, why, what function they had, but almost certainly that they mark spirit paths, you know, or certainly they are meant to control energies that were seen to permeate the landscape, and that they are almost like an interface between this world and, you know, the other world, basically. Now, obviously, we have to credit some kind of Native American culture for this, and I'm sure that's correct. But exactly who created them and when, we just don't know.
Yeah, and a lot of the stuff in New York State was just utterly wiped out. I mean, even traces of it aren't there anymore.
No, absolutely. And the other reason that we were there is an ongoing research project into the giant skeletons of the United States, which have been found in many hundreds, if not thousands, of earthen mounds, mostly dating to the Edina period, so probably around a couple of thousand years old. And many of these skeletons were found in the 19th century and appeared in newspaper reports. But we were looking not for this, but for actual academic reports of the discovery of giant skeletons, of which there are dozens and dozens and dozens, which cannot be disputed, cannot be put down to, you know, simple farming communities misinterpreting the lengths of skeletons or whatever. And there is no question that 2,000 years ago, there was an elite of giants, possibly as much as 7, maybe 7.5 feet tall, existing in various parts of the United States. There are various books out on this subject. My good friends Jim Vieira and Hugh Newman have got a new book out just this week, actually, called Giants on Record, which is all about this subject. You know, you can Google that. That's there. In fact, both of them are talking at our big conference in London, which is coming up on Saturday week, called Origins. It's the Origins of Civilization Conference, where we've got Graham Hancock talking, Jim Vieira, Hugh Newman, myself, and various other people. And obviously they're talking about the giants. And I'm very interested in this idea, because it's my belief that these giants are some kind of human hybrid. Hybrids probably between ourselves, anatomically modern humans, and this new type of human that was found in the Altai region of Siberia, known as the Denisovans, who roamed the earth certainly from about, you know, a couple of 100,000 years ago, arguably much earlier, down to around 50,000 years ago, when they seem to have disappeared. We know very little about them, but all the indications are from the very small amount of anatomical evidence that we've got so far is that they're going to be very large. The teeth are extremely large. In fact, the teeth, when they were found in this cave, known as the Denisovan Cave in the Altai region, were initially dismissed as the teeth of cave bear because they were so large. And what's interesting is that the DNA of the Denisovans seems to be very close to a much earlier form of hominid, i.e. early human type, known as Homo heidelbergensis. And heidelbergensis was known to reach 7 to 7.5 feet in height. So it looks very much like the Denisovans are the descendants of this race, and that they themselves unquestionably mated with our own ancestors and created a hybrid, and those hybrids may have continued to exist in areas like Southeast Asia, you know, places like Indonesia, but also almost certainly within the North American continent, right the way down to a couple of thousand years ago. In fact, some of their descendants may well have been present when the earliest European explorers and conquistadors and whatever arrived in the American continent at the end of the 15th century, beginning of the 16th century. Often they reported encountering the chiefs of tribes who would be anything up to 7 to 7.5 feet tall. So, you know, in other words, although the Denisovans disappear themselves 50,000 years ago, their hybrid descendants almost certainly continued through until the time of conquest, and then almost certainly would have been wiped out. But even today, we find a very small amount of DNA, anything up to 5% Denisovan DNA in peoples in various parts of the world, mostly in Central and Eastern Asia, but also amongst certain Native American tribes in the Americas themselves. In fact, three separate tribes have shown very small percentage of Denisovan DNA. So this is all very exciting stuff. I mean, you know, it's opened up a whole new field of exploration, and people are now looking at the accounts of all of these giant skeletons to see whether they could possibly be Denisovans, whether they could possibly be even one of the other earlier forms of human, like Neanderthals. There are a number of accounts of skeletons and skulls being found that have what's known as archaic features. And in other words, they almost appear to be like human throwbacks. But what that actually describes very closely is what we know to be Neanderthal anatomical features. And Greg Little, my colleague has been looking at this subject recently and has done two articles about Neanderthal-style skeletons being found in the States. Now, again, the archaeologists, anthropologists will say this is rubbish, but it's not. It's quite easy to understand if you talk not in terms of pure Neanderthals, but Neanderthal human hybrids or even Neanderthal Denisovan human hybrids. Now, I talk all about this in my contribution to a book called The Path of Souls, which was written by Greg Little. And I did the introduction and the afterword for it. And my afterword, you know, talks all about the giants being Denisovans. And I do believe it was the first ever suggestion that the giants of America could be Denisovans. And I think that I'm on the right track with this. I'm pretty certain this is where it's going to go with this investigation.
Now, do you think there's an actual conspiracy to hide these giants, or if there was at one point?
I think probably there was, and exactly why, I don't totally understand. I think a lot of it is to do with evolution, and, you know, in a Darwinian sense, but filtered through biblical ideas. Because in the Bible, we're told that there were giants in the earth in those days, according to the book of Genesis, but they were all wiped out, even before the time of the flood. So they represented like a very primitive form of humanity that shouldn't have existed after the time of Noah and the time of obviously Moses and the early prophets and things like this. So that they're almost throwback. So that the fact that they might have existed in the Americas a couple of thousand years ago and may even have been the chiefs or the ruling elite in control of the normal sized anatomically modern humans is something that anthropologists could not handle, because it suggests that those giants in the earth, those Nephilim, still existed at that time and may still have existed right the way through until the time of the conquest. So it doesn't make sense, no. And almost certainly a lot of skeletons, a lot of skulls were quietly lost, and those that weren't, and remember, most of them went to places like the Smithsonian Museum. At the beginning of the 1990s, when there was the repatriation agreement, the NAPRA law passed, whereby the tribal peoples of every region received back all of the human remains that had been found in that region, and they were then reburied. So in theory, There is no skeletons anyway. If there were any giant skeletons remaining, then all of them would have been reburied in the 1990s, just before all of the DNA testing really started. It's ironic. It's a terrible injustice, in all honesty. And it's wrong. It's absolutely wrong. I mean, although, you know, we've done the Native American peoples a great injustice, you know, this is not the way to put things right, because yeah. Now what it's doing is it's depriving science of who exactly was in the Americas prior to the time of conquest. The same law, thankfully, is not in place in Canada, and it's not in place in Mexico, so we can get quite a lot of information from DNA testing in those countries. But it's also in place in Australia. The same thing happened there. So all of the incredible, strange early skeletons that were found there, including some skulls that look really weird, have all just been lost. So, you know, but unfortunately, this is the price that we pay for having done the native peoples of America and Australia an injustice in the first place.
What do you mean by weird-looking skulls? How did they look weird?
Ones that have elongated heads to start with, elongated jaws, high cheekbones. I mean, you know, clearly the salt that you find it with in profusion in places like Peru and in Mexico and whatever, there are a number of these that were found, particularly in Australia, that could just have been natural in appearance and not artificially deformed, as right. always been assumed. You know, some cone heads, you know, may actually be natural. I mean, not the, not, I mean, you know, I mean, all right, I can't say which ones, and I don't think anybody can really say which ones. I've had lots of conversations with my friend and colleague, Brian Forrester, all about this. I was with Brian and Hugh Newman in Peru this year, in Bolivia, looking at elongated skulls of children, of adults, the rest of it, all over these countries. And some of them are an absolute enigma. I mean, it's just a very, very strange subject to study at this time, and fascinating. And I do believe that some head elongation is natural.
Yeah, it seems like some of it is. I've seen a lot of Brian Forrester's work on that, and it's, you know, some of them just don't make sense that they were elongated.
Yeah, I agree.
Now, you mentioned the Nephilim, and that's kind of the biblical version of a hybrid between humans and another race.
Absolutely, yeah, yeah. I mean, the Nephilim, as described in the book of Genesis, were the giants. I mean, that was the real word that's used to describe them. And they were said to be of extreme height, but because their fathers were the Watchers, these angelic, tall angelic figures with very pale skin and pale hair and strange looking eyes, whereas their mothers were mortal women, the offspring, the so-called Nephilim, you know, came out giants, and they ran amok, they drank blood, they killed people, they did bad things. And it said that the Watchers that were loyal to heaven rounded up the Nephilim and killed them and incarcerated their fathers. This is the story that's given in the Book of Enoch. Now, the Book of Enoch is a very, very strange book. I mean, Bible scholars will tell you that it probably is like some kind of fantasy generated from the stories in the Book of Genesis about the Watchers and the sons of God. In other words, somebody thought it was a good idea to create this fantasy book about who the sons of God or Watchers actually were, and what was the fate of their Nephilim children. But I don't think that works at all. Almost certainly, the Book of Enoch derives from a much earlier text known as the Book of Noah, which is almost exclusively about, you know, these Watchers and Nephilim. And this is something that developed outside of the Bible completely. And what you have in the Book of Genesis is almost just like a brief summary of this whole tradition to do with the Watchers and the Nephilim. And I'm pretty certain that from the research I've done, that the Watchers are a memory of a ruling elite that founded civilization in the Near East just after the end of the last ice age, about 9500 BC. And that they were behind the foundation of this incredible place, Göbekli Tepe, in southeast Turkey, this earliest ever megalithic complex, which consists of a series of stone chambers and enclosures, and lots of carved stones with T-shaped terminations. Now, the Watchers themselves are linked with the very area around Göbekli Tepe. It said that the Sabians, the astronomers of nearby Haran, which is only about 25 miles from Göbekli Tepe, that all of their knowledge came after the discovery of this stone stela, i.e. like a standing stone with inscriptions on, that was found by this guy called Canaan, who was the founding figure of Haran. And it was said that on this was the astrology of the Watchers, and that this is where all of their information came from to create their whole magical system to do with the seven planets and the 12 you know, signs of the zodiac and the different stars and the influences of the stars. So in other words, the Haranian peoples believed that all this knowledge came from them. I think you'll find this is in the Book of Jubilees. The Book of Jubilees is one of the accompanying books of, like, the Book of Enoch and the Book of Giants, things like this. You know, these have very similar stories and probably very similar origins and roots. And the nearby city of Shanlurfa, which is only about 8 miles from Göbekli Tepe, this was said to have been founded by Enoch himself. And obviously, this is the patriarch Enoch, the guy who supposedly wrote the Book of Enoch and the story of the Watchers. So, you know, there are very strong links between this tradition and the area around Göbekli Tepe. And I don't see that as a coincidence whatsoever.
No, I don't see how it could be. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back with Andrew Collins.
Where Did the Road Go can be heard first and usually live on WVBR, Saturday nights at 11 p.m. Eastern. Go to wheredidtheroadgo.com to ask questions of our live guests through the chat room. Where Did the Road Go is then re-aired on Dark Matter Radio and Deprogrammed Radio. You can download all shows for free on the website, and you can subscribe to us on Stitcher, iTunes, YouTube, or Vimeo. Additional content can be found on our video channels. You will also find our upcoming schedule, book reviews, blogs, free book downloads, links, and more. We are also on Facebook and Twitter, and if you want to help support the show, there are links to donate to us. Everything you need can be found at wheredidtheroadgo.com.
All right, so we are talking here with Andrew Collins, and one of the things about Göbekli Tepe is you've found this carved bone plaque.
That's correct, yeah. I mean, this is a very remarkable piece of work. I mean, you know, if the listeners want to look at this, just go straight onto Google and put Göbekli bone plaque and it'll all come up. Because what happened was that we lead tour groups around the area of Göbekli Tepe, and we were there and we went to the museum at Shanlurfa. Now, this contains literally hundreds, if not thousands, of items found at Göbekli Tepe and other nearby, what they call pre-pottery Neolithic sites, i.e. sites that go back to at least 9,000-9,500 BC. And I mean, they got all sorts in there, you know, sort of statues of animals, yeah, mini teeth-shaped pillars and things like this. And one of our tour group noticed a very tiny bone plaque that was inside one of the cases, and there was nothing about it other than the fact it was found at Göbekli Tepe. And he looked at it very closely and saw that the etchings on it showed two T-shaped stone pillars, exactly like those that you find at Göbekli Tepe. Now, I'm pretty certain that nobody else has recognized this. No other article has ever been published that even mentions this bone plaque, never mind the etchings actually on it. And I think the reason for this is that they find so much at Göbekli Tepe that often it just doesn't get studied. And, you know, it may have got lost, and somebody is thinking, you know, what can we put out, you know, in this new museum? Because it's almost like it's only been open for several months, this museum. And somebody's found it and thought, oh, this looks good. We'll put it with the other bone plaques. And they just put it out, and nobody's really understood what is actually on there. But more than that, standing between the pillars is a series of converging lines that give the impression of a figure standing between the pillars. And above him is a very deep peck mark with two vertical lines each side of it that almost certainly represents these stones with portholes in that are found in the north-northwest sections of the perimeter or boundary wall of the two most accomplished enclosures at Göbekli Tepe. That's enclosures C and enclosures D. And these hold stones, or porthole stones, take the place of what we would see in terms of an altar or a holy of holies. That's what they've got. Instead of an altar, they've got these polished standing stones with these holes in them. So what are these holes? Well, the main archaeologist that uncovered Göbekli Tepe, his name was Professor Klaus Schmidt. He died last year. He never mentioned anything about these holed stones, but he did talk about these strange stone rings that had been found in pieces on the site when he first got there in 1995. And he believed that they were like holes that were in, you know, that were set up in the walls of some of the enclosures. And he felt that they were sealant, what he called in his native German language, Seelenloch, which means soul hole. And he suggested that they could exist for the spirit of the shaman to exit from this physical environment and go into another worldly realm. There are many traditions amongst shamanism that use holes, either within rock or within wood, within bone, within natural places like, you know, holes within grounds, you know, springs or wells, to exit this world and enter into the upper world or the lower world or whatever it is that their destination is. And so he speculated on them, and I'm pretty certain that these stones, these standing stones with holes in, big holes, I mean, they're about 12 inches in diameter, represent soul holes. And that's exactly what you've got on the bone plaque. You have a representation of twin pillars, a figure standing there, looking at one of these soul hole stones. And what's even more incredible is that above the T-shaped pillars are three peck marks in a line. And these correspond to the astronomical positions of three bright stars in the constellation of Cygnus, the celestial bird. Now, the reason why that's important is because myself and my colleague Rodney Hale, a British chartered engineer, worked out that the main enclosures at Göbekli Tepe were aligned towards the setting of the brightest star in Cygnus, which is called Deneb. And this work has been verified recently by two Italian archaeoastronomers and been published in a peer-reviewed journal. So the fact that you've got these three stars of Cygnus above the T-shaped pillars is confirmation that the enclosures seem to be focused in that direction towards this particular star system. And I find that absolutely incredible. So, you know, you've got everything summed up in this tiny little bone plaque. And I've done an academic article about this now. I've done popular articles, and all of these are available online. So, you know, have a look out for those. But this is just a very cool discovery, basically. And I'm certain that the academics had no knowledge of what was on that bone plaque.
And it kind of has a three-dimensional feel to it as well, which is unusual.
It does, yeah. I mean, I would say it is arguably the oldest usage of a three-dimensional perspective in prehistoric art. So that says something about the artist, that artist was not simply trying to create some kind of two-dimensional thing, that they were trying to give a three-dimensional perspective in this very tiny thing. And I mean, the size of this bone plaque, I mean, it's just under 6 centimeters, which is what, I don't know, about an inch and a half in height and about 3/4 of an inch in width. And only, less than probably an eighth to 1/4 of an inch in thickness. I mean, it's a remarkable thing. I mean, it's a tiny, tiny thing. I mean, I missed what was on there. I mean, I walked past it several times, and I'd been in the museum before. I had not noticed what was on there. Mind you, my eyes are bad, so that doesn't mean anything.
Now, of course, people like Graham Hancock and Robert Schock don't agree with the alignment theory. They're looking at Orion, aren't they?
That's correct, yeah. I mean, there's a lot of debate here. I mean, in my opinion, there is a certain interest in the constellation of Orion, which goes beyond normal assessment of what you might call the archaeoastronomy of sites. In other words, I think people think that every site in the world is orientated towards Orion, simply because, you know, Robert Bouval in the 1990s said that the pyramids are aligned to Orion. But it's not the case. I mean, at Göbekli Tepe, the enclosures there are clearly orientated towards the north. But for some reason, Robert Schock and others, including Graham Hancock, have decided that, no, they must be facing towards Orion. Therefore, it makes sense of why the Sphinx is on the Giza Plateau and probably dates to a similar period to Göbekli Tepe, 9,500 BC, and that there was some kind of proto-pyramid field in existence at that time. And, you know, it's all part of a bigger picture. Well, you know, that's a nice idea, but that's not what the evidence suggests at Göbekli Tepe. And these Italian archaeoastronomers, who are academics, have confirmed this northerly alignment of the sites of the enclosures at Göbekli Tepe recently. And Graham Hancock, who's I've known for 20 years, I mean, you know, he says, oh, well, it doesn't work because, you know, there's solid rock behind there somewhere within the mound. Well, it's not. The whole entire mound, the Tepe, that gives Göbekli Tepe its name, is artificial. The enclosures, the earliest enclosures there, were built on the bedrock, level bedrock, that would have allowed those structures a view of the horizon 360 degrees, most likely. So there is nothing to suggest that they're orientated to the south. Plus, as I've shown in publication, the alignments towards Orion just do not work for that period. They're faulty. And I've actually had discussions with Robert Schock about this, and his answer was, well, I didn't mean that they were absolutely accurate. I mean, I just meant that they were pointing roughly in the direction of Orion. Well, I'm sorry, you can't do that. You can't suggest that they're just generally pointing in that direction. You know, you've got to have some backup, and you need precision alignments to even consider where these monuments are pointing towards.
Now, what is the oldest part of Göbekli Tepe so far?
The oldest part dates probably to around 9,500 to 9,600 BC. And this is a very important time because it's just after the end of what's known as the Younger Dryas event. And this is a 1,200-year mini ice age that gripped the northern hemisphere. It's also a time that we know a lot of bad things were going on in the world, possibly cosmic events, earthquakes, floods, droughts, a lot of migrations, a lot of different cultures disappear completely during this period, including the Clovis culture in America. And it seems to have been triggered in around 10,800 BC by a cataclysm, one involving almost certainly the fragmentation of a comet that came in, probably went around the sun, broke into fragments and bombarded the Earth over a period of days and created wildfires that blackened out the sun and the moon, created what we'd now refer to as a nuclear winter, and triggered this ice age, this mini ice age, and that remained for a period of 1,200 years. And then it too disappeared almost overnight within a generation. And there may well have been another cataclysm at the end of it, marking its end as well. So these were not good times to live, to be honest. And you can't disconnect Göbekli Tepe from any of this. Almost certainly, whoever constructed Göbekli Tepe, for whatever reason, it had something built into it so that it could act as like an early warning system of, you know, comets and things like that coming into the sky. In other words, the astronomer priests, the shamans that were doing work there, part of their beliefs and practices revolved around repelling the supernatural forces that were seen to cause these cataclysms. And that's certainly not out the norm. You find all over the world different rituals in old anthropological books that were done whenever comets came into the sky in the belief that these comets could cause catastrophe. You know, all of this is in my book, Göbekli Tepe, Genesis of the Gods, which came out last year, which is what I say. I mean, there's even clear images of what I would see as comets on some of these stones at Göbekli Tepe. And of course, if this is just after the time of a major cataclysm, this would have been at the forefront of people's minds. I mean, it would have overridden anything else. But I think that these are gateway to the stars, these enclosures. That's exactly what they were. They were interfaces between this world and the star world.
And why Cygnus?
Because placed on the Milky Way, where the Milky Way bifurcates or forks to create what's known as the Dark Rift or the Great Rift. And this is something that goes from Cygnus all the way down to the area of Scorpio. And Scorpio is where the sun crosses the Milky Way. So often this is the spot on the horizon where the Milky Way rises up from. Yeah, you know, just after sunset or just before dawn or whatever. So it forms almost like a bridge or an arch from the area of Scorpio right the way up to Cygnus, which would have been right in the center of the sky, crossing what they call the north-south meridian line at that very time on the Milky Way. But more important to this is that 5,000 years before Göbekli Tepe, the bright star Deneb in Cygnus was the pole star. And for a period of around 2,500 years, the Milky Way swiveled like a propeller in motion around the stars of Cygnus every night of the year, just turning and turning and turning. And every night it would align north-south perfectly. In other words, the Milky Way would start in the north, it would rise up overhead and go south. It's the only time that it's ever done that in the whole of the cycle. It's the only time that the Milky Way that the Milky Way lines up with the pole star. And I think that these beliefs were so important to the peoples from around 16,000 to about 14,500 BC. That it set up the stars of Cygnus as the point of entry into the sky world, you know, plus the fact you've got the dark rift that comes from Scorpio to that position as well. And I think these beliefs continued on even after Deneb lost its pole position to Vega in the constellation of Lyra, which isn't on the Milky Way. It's some distance away from there if you look at it in the sky. And the belief in the importance of Cygnus with its position so prominently on the Milky Way remained down to the time of Göbekli Tepe. I think that a lot of what was going on at Göbekli Tepe related to beliefs and practices that were already many thousands of years old. That's why Cygnus was so important at that site.
Okay. And do you think there could be older structures of Göbekli Tepe we just haven't found yet?
Well, this is something that Graham Hancock and I talk about. We don't think so, no. I mean, you might find some very primitive huts or something in the vicinity, but you're not going to find the prototypes of the huge great monuments that you see there that were constructed at 9,500 BC. You're not going to see a whole load of experimentation over a period of 5,000 years or something until you get the perfection that you see with Enclosure C and Enclosure D, for instance. They're the two biggest and most accomplished of the monuments there. You're not going to see that. And why? Because the knowledge of how to create this megalithic architecture almost certainly comes from somewhere else. Now, Graham and I differ on where that knowledge comes from. In his book, Magicians of the Gods, which has just come out, he talks about it coming from Southeast Asia, a sunken region known as Sundaland, which is now corresponds with the whole area of Indonesia. Mm-hmm. I talk about the precursors of the Göbekli Tepe culture coming from the north, from the area of Russia, connected with the Swiderian culture, where we know that there was that there was, you know, this incredible sophistication of carved art going back to 30,000 BC. But also connected with all of this, and another descendancy coming out of the area of Russia, were the so-called Seleucidian peoples who end up colonizing Western Europe. And there's stories about them getting in boats and continuing on and going across to North America and becoming the Clovis culture. Well, that may or may not be the case, but what we do know about the Seleucidians is that they were the first people to carve blocks of stone and create images very similar to the carved heads of the T-shaped pillars at Göbekli Tepe. And I don't think that's a coincidence. Both the Swiderians and the Seleucidians come from exactly the same ancestors, and that was the so-called Gravatian peoples of the area of Russia. And they also had colonies in what is today Czechoslovakia. Those were their two main centers, what is today the Czech Republic and Central Russia.
And what do you think was the second event, the one that would have ended the Ice Age?
Well, I mean, to be honest, I don't even talk about that in my book, but Graham Hancock does mention it, and he does give a few references. He suggests, and as I said, does give the references for this, that something terrible happened at the end of the Younger Dryas event. And I'm in contact with a guy by the name of Han Klusterman. Now, he's a guy that's been researching the idea of this cataclysm. He's actually found this burnt carbon-rich layer in many countries around the world, which is, you know, about anything from a few inches to about 8 inches in thickness, which has contained things like nano diamonds and extraterrestrial materials, burnt materials, you know, all evidence suggesting that this was laid down during some kind of cataclysm. Now, it's known as the Usillo Horizon after the place in Belgium that it was first detected by Hans Klusterman. And I talked to him about this, and he also firmly believes that something did occur at the end of the Younger Dryas around 9,600 BC. But I don't think we know enough about it yet. Not enough has come out. And the problem has been a lot of confusion in dates, because today, radiocarbon dating necessitates the recalibration of dates due to the fact of fluctuations in the level of this radioactive substance known as carbon-14 within organic materials. This was not known, let's say, in the 1950s, 60s, 70s, when a lot of the early carbon dating was done. But the recalibration, particularly when you go back 10 to 12,000 years, will push back a date, maybe by 1,000 or 1,500 years. So you've got a whole lot of set of old dates out there and a whole load of set of new dates. And there's so much confusion about what happened when that there is, you know, that we're only just getting a clear picture of when the Younger Dryas started, which is now considered to be about 10,800 BC, and it ended 1,200 years later, about 9,600 BC. And it was directly after that the Göbekli Tepe is constructed. But exactly what happened in 9,600 BC is still a mystery. I mean, Robert Schopp, for instance, denies that there was even a cataclysm took place. He thinks it was all solar flares and stuff like this, which is bizarre.
He still counts it as a cataclysm. He just thinks it came from the sun.
Yes, but he doesn't believe that there was a major event in 10,800 BC.
Mm.
And, I mean, Graham Hancock spoke to me about this quite recently. He said, I don't understand it. He said, but Robert Schott doesn't even believe that this took place. And I noticed that within the past couple of weeks, Robert Schott has come out publicly and said this, that there was no comet impact. Whereas the evidence that's accumulating all the way around the world is overwhelming.
Yeah.
Related to this comet impact. I mean, how anybody can even deny it these days is bizarre. But I think it's because Robert Schock is too entrenched in these ideas of solar flares. He's gone with that in his book, Forgotten Civilization.
Yes.
And I think that it's so deeply entrenched in his use of symbolism and things like that, that he's going to find that very difficult to come away from those ideas now. So I think that, you know, that's his choice.
Right, right. So what was I just going to ask you? What is like the most misunderstood thing you hear about Göbekli Tepe?
That it was deliberately buried at the last minute. I mean, Robert Schock says this. I constantly get people write to me saying, why was Göbekli Tepe buried, you know, at the end of its time in 8000 BC? And I have to go back every time and say to people, it was not deliberately buried. Yes, at the end of its useful life, the final enclosures were covered over and, you know, and the whole thing just filled in, you know, like, I mean, it's a little bit like a refuge tip. Yeah. I mean, a refuge tip, you know, is there on the landscape, and then when they've got too much, they'll cover it over with earth. Yeah. Well, if you can imagine that going on at Göbekli Tepe, and it was, I mean, they covered over the enclosures that they didn't need, the ones at the bottom, with every refuge and crap and whatever, stone, rubble, chippings, imported earth, everything, just to cover them over so that they could get a level ground to build another structure on top of that. Then when they had enough of that one, they decommissioned that one, they covered that one over, and they built another one on top of that. And that's how this occupational mound, this tepe, gets constructed very gradually over a period of 1,500 years. And what's left eventually is a beautiful belly-shaped hill on the top of a mountain ridge. And that's the way it remained for 10,000 years until it was rediscovered in the 1990s by Klaus Schmidt. So, you know, you can't say that those structures were deliberately buried for some profound reason. They were buried because once they were decommissioned, it was considered that the spirit, the energy, whatever it was associated with them, had to be shut down, returned back to the earth. Remember, all the stones that they used came from the earth in the first place. They quarried them out of the earth. So what they're doing is they're giving it back to the earth. That's what they're doing. It's nothing to do with cataclysms. Nothing to do with preserving it for, you know, future generations, in my opinion.
Okay. Where did the people who built this go?
I think that they, well, okay. Firstly, something big happened right in the middle of Göbekli Tepe. And that's agriculture. Because when Göbekli Tepe started in 9500 BC, everything was hunter-gathering. You know, people were after the big game. They were nomadic for the most part. But for some reason, they were brought together and they created Göbekli Tepe. Now, why were everybody brought together? Probably because there was a common need to construct these things. And I think it has something to do with the cataclysm and trying to ensure that the cataclysms don't happen again. Because I think that you'll find that all the way around the world, monuments like this were being constructed, possibly Gunung Padang in Java, this huge pyramid hill, megalithic structure, maybe even Stonehenge in my own country in England. The earliest parts of what they call the proto-Stonehenge go back to 8000 BC. Huge, great wooden posts and various sites that seem to form part of a sacred complex. And I think this was going all the way around the world. So that's what was going on with Göbekli Tepe. Now, more than this is the fact that you have agriculture coming along, because suddenly you've got hundreds, if not thousands, of people involving in these projects, particularly around Göbekli Tepe. You need to feed these people. If you just go after the local game, the local herds of animals, that food source is still soon going to be depleted. So almost certainly they devised agriculture and obviously animal domestication, everything, all of which starts off in this area from around 9000 BC. So by the time you come to around 8500, it's all about agriculture. It's all about agricultural cycles, the importance of ripening crop. So suddenly the interest is beginning to switch away from the stars and the moon, which I think were both very important at Göbekli Tepe, and people are now focusing their attentions on the sun. And this is reflected in the fact that the much younger enclosures at Göbekli Tepe all seem to be aligned to the sun. Mm. And that I find interesting. I mean, for instance, right on the top of the mound is one called the Lion Pillar Building. And this is aligned east-west, clearly east-west, with twin pillars towards the eastern end. And on those twin pillars are these beautiful lions that roar up at you on the inner sides of them. And this is aligned to the sunrise at the time of the equinoxes. Now, what we know is that just before the sun rose at the equinox, the spring equinox, in, let's say, 8500 BC, were the stars of Leo, the lion. So did these lions represent Leo? I think that's a very strong possibility. But I think that the rising sun itself probably also represented the power and might of the lion, just as they did in Egypt. Various different lion-headed goddesses were known as the Eye of Ra. And, you know, including Sekhmet, the most obvious of them, they represented the might of the sun. You know, obviously with the Eye of Ra being the sun itself. And I think that these ideas started at places like Göbekli Tepe. And so your answer is, I think that there were schisms. I think that there was a lot of changes of ideas, and this caused certain peoples to go off and do their own thing. And this was, in many ways, the beginning of the spread of the Neolithic Revolution.
What do you believe that there was a worldwide civilization before the comet hit during the last ice age?
No.
Okay.
I don't. If there was, you would find evidence of their portable objects all over the world. And I'm talking here for the most part about stone tools. The Solutrians of Western Europe created the most incredibly sophisticated and beautiful stone tools from around 20,000 years ago down to about 17,000 years ago. They were the pinnacle of achievement in the Paleolithic of stone tool manufacture. They used a process known as pressure flaking, and this allowed for the most beautiful finishes. You find that same finishes on things like the Clovis points in North America, and many, many other types of points, Folsom points, and many other, you know, archaic period points that are found in America. But in the Eurasian continent, it was the Solutrians that achieved this greatest pinnacle of achievement with the stone tools. And the reason I'm saying that is because you don't find it in other parts of the world. It's just not there until you get to the Neolithic period, which begins, obviously, with Göbekli Tepe in 9500 BC. And I think that you would find evidence of it, because where is it? I mean, yeah, where I can't see it. What I do believe is that there are flowerings of civilization that rise in a certain area, maybe China, maybe Russia, maybe Southeast Asia, maybe the Americas. And it's like a flower that opens for a period of time, maybe a few thousand years. And during this period, this particular culture or population advance very quickly. And then something bad happens, maybe a cataclysm, maybe, you know, famine or something occurs. And it's like a flower then closes. And that civilization dies. And I think that was going on from around 50,000 years ago through until the Neolithic period. And what galvanized everybody to come together to create a global civilization was the cataclysms themselves. I do not believe that there was a global civilization that was wiped out prior to the cataclysm.
Okay. One of the interesting things that's been in the news is this potential alien megastructure, and that kind of connects into Cygnus as well.
Absolutely.
I mean, whatever it might actually be.
Well, I've written a whole article about this. It's up online, and I find this very fascinating indeed. I mean, we're talking about a star in the constellation of Cygnus, very close to Deneb, by the way, and the Kepler space telescope has been looking at it for the last since 2011, and at least a couple of times and other fluctuations as well have dimmed the brightness of that star in an irregular manner by up to 20%. And so irregular is it that it's obviously not a planet in orbit crossing the face of that star, because the pattern that makes, the signature or signal, is very easy to recognize. That's what these planet hunters are looking for. This is something completely different. And a recent paper has given a number of suggestions as to what you could be looking at here: swarms of comets, swarms of meat of asteroids, a gaseous matter or something other weird and wonderful. But what's so important is that the scientists that created this paper have seriously suggested that one of the answers is that it's alien hardware, some kind of alien megastructure. And this megastructure could be what's known as a Dyson sphere, or some form of the what they call the Dyson series now, because obviously there are different ideas. And what this is was a guy called Freeman Dyson in 1960 in what is referred to as a thought experiment, and I put that in inverted commas, decided this idea, and this was the fact that civilizations would eventually use up all of the energy resources of their own planet, and they would need to get that energy from somewhere else. So they would look either towards their own sun or a sun in another system if they have, you know, sort of the capability to get to another solar system. And they would then harness that energy direct, which would then be utilized on their home planet or wherever else they were for communications, for space flight, computers, and whatever else they would need that energy for. And the Dyson Sphere, the idea of this was some kind of array of objects, possibly even completely encasing a star and generating that energy away in some manner. And that's what the scientists believe could be going on there. But there's a few problems here, because firstly, clearly it's not a Dyson Sphere because it's not covering the whole thing. So right. Some people have suggested it could be one in the making, but that seems a bit unlikely that we should just happen to capture when they're building one of these things. And I think that there's something in this, but it may not be a Dyson Sphere. It could be something else, something more exotic that we don't properly understand yet. And it could be extraterrestrial in nature. And it's something that I'm looking into at the moment. But here's something interesting. This particular star system, where this star is 1,480 light years from here, in the direction of Cygnus, of course.
Right.
But beyond that, at around 26,000 light years, very close to it, and within a 10 degree, you know, sort of span from there to here, is a star known as Cygnus X3. This is either a black hole or a neutron star or something even more exotic that is pouring out cosmic rays that reach our Earth directly without getting bounced around like most cosmic rays do, because they are neutrally charged and they penetrate so deep into our planet that underground particle facility places register them incoming. And they know that they're coming from this particular star because the cycle is 4.8 hours. Is it hours? Yeah, 4.8 hours. Hold on. Could have that messed up. Yes, no, that's right. And the importance with this is that I proposed in my book, The Cygnus Mystery, that these unique cosmic rays may have been involved in human evolution, affecting human evolution. And this, and I'm not alone in suggesting something similar to this. I mean, Carl Sagan himself, in one of his books, I think it was The Cosmic Connection, talks about cosmic rays being responsible for human evolution. And so if this evolution is affecting us down here, the same rays, which are obviously are closer to this other star system, directly in line between here and Cygnus X3, could it be possible that those same cosmic rays were affecting life in that star system far earlier than they were down here? And if that's the case, is there a relationship between the evolution of aliens in that star system and ourselves down here? That is a very exciting thought.
Yes,
it is. Of course, this is speculation. I have no answers, and nobody has any real answers at the moment. But I like where this is going.
are there any magnetic anomalies on Göbekli Tepe?
I don't know whether anybody's actually ever done anything like that. I mean, it's a difficult thing, because when I first went there in 2004, there was nobody there. I mean, there was just the local farmer and his son that came over to say hello. Now, they're trying to make it into a new Stonehenge.
Right.
You know, they've got, you know, that you have to get into a van, you know, like a minibus to come up to the site now. There is a walkways. You can't go off those walkways. It's very difficult to do much. And I mean, when we do our tours over there, I insist that we go twice, the first time quite formally in the morning, and the second time in an afternoon, when the sun goes, just before the sun goes down, when there's nobody there, and people can just study the place on their own, do their own thing, and that's beautiful. And at that time, you might be able to do something up there on your own, but this would have to be unofficial, you know? I mean...
Right.
You know, you'd have to just try and see what happened, but I don't think anything like that's been really checked at the site. I mean, they've had geophysical surveys, geo radar surveys, but these are all quite conventional.
Right. Do you have any tours going there anytime soon?
Yep. If people want to come with us to Göbekli Tepe, we've got two tours next year. One's a full Turkey one in May. Origins of Civilization, that's called. You'll find all this on andrewcollins.com, by the way, my website. And then in September, we got what we call a Göbekli Tepe mini tour to Göbekli Tepe, Haran, Karahan Tepe, which is its sister site, all the sites of Şanlıurfa, including the museum where the bone plaque is. And the guy that basically found the carvings on the bone plaque, he was one of the guys in our tour, and he's written himself into history, you know. And nice. So can you, if you come with us on these tours, we can discover anything. Every year we discover something new, you know. That's what's going on out there right now. You can be a part of that if you want. So,
and
all the information's there on andrewcollins.com.
Are there any issues with safety out that way?
Well, I mean, obviously there's been a couple of, attacks out there. I mean, one in Ankara, as we know, and you know, there was another shooting very close to the border near the Syrian town of Kobani. But hey, you know, I mean, what can I say? I mean, these places are probably as safe as Britain or any other major European city at the moment, I'm afraid.
Yeah,
you know, it's these things can happen anywhere. So, I mean, we've never seen any problems whatsoever, ever. And everybody's okay. Always nice to us. Kurd, you know, Turk, Arab, everybody's really nice. And they loathe what's going on over the border in Syria. Far as they're concerned, these people are not even Muslims, because, you know, good Muslims would not do this sort of thing.
Right, right. Anything else people should know that you have coming up? You got a new book you're working on?
Yes, I've got a book which is supposed to be done by the end of January, and I haven't started it yet. And it's evolving because I'm supposed to have been writing it. It's supposed to be about human hybrids. It will be about human hybrids, but all of this great developments that have been going on in the ancient mysteries subject over the past few months are changing the contents. The bone plaque will feature in it big time. So, we just have to see what comes out over the winter months, as I'm laboring away here 15 hours a day, all over Christmas, all over New Year, all over my birthday in January. we just have to see what comes out.
All right. Well, thank you for spending some time with us, Andrew.
It's my pleasure. I'll speak again.
between states of consciousness. I remember a time I was dead before I was born. The legend inside us, the spirit reminds us from the mass.